Daddy, what are you doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy. Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about the school to prison pipeline. And I've got two amazing guests with me today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
I'll go first. So my name is Craig Pinkney. I am a criminologist, urban youth specialist, and the CEO of an organisation called SOLVE, the Centre for Youth Violence and Conflict. And essentially, it's around responding to violence and harm of all forms, and supporting children and young people that are perpetrators and also victims of violent behaviour.
Great stuff.
My name is Joel Dunn, and I'm the CEO and founder of a grassroots charity called Paradigm Project. And our work is set up to tackle complex youth issues from a preventative angle. And I'm also researching the school to prison pipeline.
Okay, great stuff, great stuff. So we've got, we've got a couple big time players within the industry. So it's great to, you know, to have you guys on board with me today. So one of the things that I wanted to kick off with, especially around this theme of school to prison pipeline, is the idea that many have that, you know, that exclusions, you know, permanent exclusions, suspensions and whatever else, that plays a big part into the sort of gateway, into criminalisation. And essentially I wanted to get an idea or a sense from you both, like what sort of impact do we see from students who or young people who are excluded from school, and them sort of getting into like criminalization from either like your work experience, mm-hmm. or from any research that you guys have done in your respective fields.
I think before we go straight into impacts, I think it's important sometimes that we contextualize what we're talking about here. So we say flippantly the school to prison pipeline, but what exactly are we talking about? How early are we talking? Are we talking predominantly secondary, or are we talking primary? And in terms of my experience, I would even challenge some of those ideas and notions. Maybe we should be looking at the nursery to prison pipeline, because my experience working within education for over 15 years and working at nursery level and also in primary, a lot of the issues that we see within systems that take our children and our babies into those systems are continuously failing them. And then the adverse impact of those failures, we then start to see outside within communities. So of course we can look at some of the social factors and some of the factors that may exist within communities as a whole. But when we look at the education system, is it set up in order to enable our children and our young people to prosper, or are they being failed at so many different levels? And I think that unpacking, when we're talking about the school to prison pipeline, I think it sometimes needs a bit of clarity for our audience to know what are we talking about. Because some individuals that may be watching work in primary, some may be working in secondary, but I also know nursery practitioners that will be saying, no, even as young as 5 and 6, there's issues that need to be engaged and dealt with. And I think some of those external factors that may have an adverse impact on some of the factors that we see within education start to sometimes overlap. And we've got, some of the things we'll probably talk about today, like technology and, you know, neurodivergence and a whole host of other things.
I'd echo what you said. I think the most of the existing bodies of research start from point of behavioural issues, school exclusion, involvement in the criminal justice system. So when they're talking about the school to prison pipeline, they talk from there. A call to action, a quote from Desmond Tutu that I often speak about, is how long are we going to keep pulling the bodies out the stream until we have to go further upstream and find out why they're falling in the first place? And that for me is really like, it guides my focus and of the work that I'm doing. And I spoke on a panel recently about racism in schools, and someone asked a question, well, how far is upstream enough? And then I was speaking about how black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in pregnancy, and how inequality for the child can start from that first experience. So when we're talking about the school to prison pipeline, it's not just picking it up at point of behavior issues or exclusion from school is reactionary. And I think for me, that's what my work and my academic pursuit is all about, is what are the upstream solutions to tackling these complex youth issues, or these complex youth issues that young people experience, and not limiting it. So even the school to prison pipeline label has become associated with my name through the work that I'm doing. But actually my work is about dismantling the school to prison pipeline, and it's not a theory or a model that you know that I think is positive. And I think, you know, it, looking at it from how can it be dismantled from the earliest possible opportunity is really where the focus needs to be.
No, that's some good points, and I think and that's why it's important for us to have these, you know, discussions, because, you know, for as long as I've been an educator and I've been thinking about this theme of school to prison pipeline, again, I used to just see it as, you know, from the point of exclusions and suspensions, etc. But then if we're saying that, you know, we need to look beyond, and we need to look at our systems as early as primary and nursery and whatever else, whose responsibility is that then? So, because if I'm an educator and I'm in secondary school and I know that within my school we have issues around, you know, suspensions and exclusions, and I want to reduce that within secondary, but I know that, you know, there are systemic issues that start, you know, earlier in terms of primary and nursery, but I work within a secondary system. Is that then saying that accountability or response?
I think it speaks to the point that you said systems change. Craig, you already spoke about systems. I think it's interdisciplinary systems change that is needed. I think far too often when we speak about these issues, it becomes like, I'll throw one thing from my side of the fence, binary opinions, or where do we pass the blame? Is it a parental issue? Is it a school issue? Does the blame belong to society? All of those narratives are reductionist and don't allow us to actually speak to the problem. Because once we understand that these are our young people, this is our community, they'll grow up to be the leaders of our communities. It is all of our problem. And I think, you know, that defensiveness sometimes can block us from having the conversations that we need to have, you know. And I think, you know, I think one thing that I think is important for me to state is when we're talking about the school to prison pipeline and exclusions, for me, there's no blame on the schools and on the teachers within them. I think there's amazing work that they do within them. It's that the system as a whole isn't set up to support the children that we know are most disadvantaged and need the most help. And that goes beyond those school walls. You know, that's how are we supporting the teachers? How are we supporting people in the community to work with these young people? How are we supporting parents? You know, so I think without that systems lens, we can't have a proper conversation about where the issues are.
And I think I'd just, you know, align with some of what's been said in terms of, you know, we can't just point the finger. For my position is that everybody has responsibility and accountability. And I guess where a lot of our work comes in is about how do we critically reflect on those individuals within systems? Because sometimes when we even use word like systems, it's almost like we use the word system almost like a UFO that's kind of like dangling, but it's actually human beings that work within these systems. Yeah. So my journey is all about who's within these systems and what it is that, what are they doing? So when we talk about things like interdisciplinary issues that kind of arise, one of the things that come up for me is, one, a lot of practitioners, in terms of the way in which they're educated within the education system, is sometimes not fit for purpose in the environments in which many of the people are working. So, for example, we know in a lot of primary and secondary schools, there's a lot of educators that may mean well, that are amazing, but they have no cultural competency, no knowledge of the communities and the environments in which they work. They're not very cultural sensitive to some of the nuances that may exist in particular types of communities. So a lot of issues when we're talking about the clashes of culture sometimes can also be an issue within itself. And then you've also got to talk about children and young people that are coming from, you know, completely different backgrounds, and some of those backgrounds where there may be issues around trauma, where there may be issues around issues around acute poverty, and what does that mean in terms of the context of a child or young person coming into a school and they probably haven't eaten this morning? Mm. Are people sensitive to those particular types of environments? So we can go down a whole lane of pointing fingers of who done what and who should be accountable. But I think it's important that having these kind of critical conversations to unpack and make sense of what's going on within these environments, I think is crucial. But I think my role in terms of professional development, those are the things that I will look at. You know, are professionals, educators, are they, you know, up to date with youth culture? You know, are they up to date with the nuances of social media and social media platforms and things that are going on? You know, it shouldn't take for something like Netflix's, you know, adolescence, you know, to be aired on our TV screens for all of a sudden that every educator now wants to talk about misogyny, you know, violence towards girls and young women. These things are supposed to be embedded, but who are the ones to embed it? It's not just systems, it's human beings that work in systems. But when we allow the systems to essentially take over without taking leadership, without shaking the status quo, then it allows and creates those environments for our children that are disenfranchised and disaffected to be adversely impacted even more.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the key things, though, that I would say to that is I see the relationship between the people and working within the systems. I see one of the major problems of there being no metric to measure anything other than than academic outputs or behavior labels.
Yes.
There's nothing that measures who the child is. We don't develop the child is. We ask the question when things go wrong as they're adults, and we expect them to work it out for themselves when they're in society. Yeah. But for me, it's about a radical reimagination of what metrics could we use to measure how we develop the child across the board.
Yeah.
And then even more so, we know that for the children who are disadvantaged or need that extra support, then we can understand, you know, how they're being supported in those ways in the school, how they could be supported in the same ways outside of the school. So for me, that's one of the things that I've been exploring is, you know, currently children can go through 17 years of education from reception to year 11 and we'll still be asking who they are when they get out the other end. And to me, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Because if school's the only metrics they have or what they're rewarded on or measured on is just about academic output, then we are just going to keep repeating that cycle that is, you know, overlooking the children that need the most help.
No, that's important. And I think one of the key things that, you know, is really stood out for me is, like, from hearing what you've both said, essentially I'm seeing exclusion now rather than being the starting point, which many observers might see as the starting point for the school to prison pipeline. Essentially, it could just be maybe a catalyst, because really there are things that have been put in place that have been happening within the systems where essentially whether their exclusion and suspensions had happened or not, you know, certain young people, certain students, because of their upbringing, you know, society and poverty and, you know, family and contextual settings, would have been vulnerable to engaging, you know, in, you know, criminal activities and whatever else, irrespective of an exclusion or, you know, suspension happening. Whereas I think before having this conversation, and there could be many people listening who may have had a similar mindset to me, who would have just thought, oh, you know what, they get excluded, and because they're excluded, they're roaming the streets, and because they're roaming the streets, they're going to be vulnerable to, you know, gang exploitation, and it started from the exclusion. But, you know, I love the fact that you guys both started with giving context, because what practitioners and, you know, educators and people need to do now is say, actually, that's a reductionist view. That's an easy route to just say it's their exclusion, because it means now we don't have to look at the deeper, you know, issues that's happening.
Exactly what you just said. I think, how many times, Craig, have you heard head teachers say, we haven't had an excluded pupil for years? And it's almost like they're boasting. And I get it, because they're being asked to reduce exclusions. But when we focus as that being the main point, then we see the numbers, we see the statistics churned out, we've reduced exclusions, but what does that mean for the child in your school that's in need? What does that mean for the child in your school that's not seen or heard, you know? So for me, it's that conversation about metrics. What are we doing to develop the child that we already know is vulnerable?
And if you were to change the metrics and ask how many children feel like they're full at the end of the day?
Yeah.
How many children feel like their well-being or their mental health is different from going into school and coming out? Changing that metric gives you a better understanding of the systems of which these children are almost, you know, contained within. Yeah, yeah. And it's about not just the children's experience, but it's also the staffing experience. Because I'm also conscious as well that when we have these conversations, and that's why I said it's not about pointing the finger at one particular group or individual, because we also have to talk about time.
Yeah.
You know, we have to also talk about the challenges within systems. We know from the last 10 years of the cuts and the impacts that's had on education, there's a lot of things now being removed. You know, we're talking about, you heard me mention earlier on about children and young people being neurodivergent and the adverse impact that might have within the classroom. Somebody's only doing a session for 45 minutes or 50 minutes and they need to get children out from another room. Having to deal with all of those extra issues, you know, might be something that teachers will think is easier to just remove that individual from the room, put them in isolation, suspend them, and the road goes on.
That's a key point, though, because I think one of I see as a shared strength that we have is that we don't belong completely to the education space. We don't belong completely to the youth, but we kind of straddle different sectors, and that allows us to have a different perspective. But I think also it's important, you know, the empathy that you're showing. We're not saying that more needs to be done in school and it's the teachers that should be doing it, which is often a defense that comes when you're talking about the school to prison pipeline or exclusion. We're saying, for me, it's about, you know, where are the resources being pushed further upstream? Where's the funding being pushed further upstream? Because for me, it seems obvious that what we're doing right now, the reactionary approach that we have, like look at the state of local authorities and how much they overspend, the acute spending related to crisis, and how that sits in juxtaposition to what's being spent at, you know, at a preventative angle. So for me, it's not about saying the people in the schools or the parents need to do more. It's how are we supporting them to be able to support those children? For me, like, we don't need another piece of research to tell us what makes children vulnerable. We don't need it. We know those things already.
20 years deep of research.
Yeah. So I think for me, I always say that change is disruptive, right? And when I sit at tables, I don't want to be regurgitating conversations that happened 15, 20 years before me, albeit they might have been packaged with different themes and different topical conversations. But, you know, we shouldn't, to me, I've failed if in 10 years' time the conversation is still, you know, what should we do about addressing these children or that specific group of children? Because the conversation needs to shift to how are we supporting them and what are we doing differently?
Yeah, no, that's important. And I wanted to ask as well, so if we're looking at, if we're looking at the life of a young person and we're considering, you know, their childhood from nursery into, you know, secondary school, etc. Let's say that there was a young person who may be struggling with, you know, poverty and all of these things within the home, but the nursery teachers, the school teachers, you know, they're seeing these behaviours and they're labelling them as, you know, disruptive, challenging and, you know, all of these things. But it could be, as you mentioned earlier, I've not had breakfast today. Mum's gone on night shift, you know, single parent. It could be various things, but they're getting all of these labels that is going through them, you know, going through with them, like in primary or secondary, etc. Does that have an impact on their engagement into like criminalization and that sort of activity outside of school? Does labeling really have that impact?
It's layered, and I think again, conceptualization of these things makes sense that we kind of unpack things. So the first thing for me is about, rather than looking at it through a silo lens, we need to start to intersect things, because it might be that they're a challenge because they're hungry, but it could be that they're challenging because not only they're hungry, they don't understand what's been said to them. And I think that when we start to look at those intersectional lenses and how they align with each other at different moments, that enables us to make better sense, as opposed to the reason why you're behaving like that is because you haven't eaten, or the reason why you behave like that is because your older brother has gone through something and they got arrested the day before. It's about how do we intersect all of them? And then we look at it through an intersectional lens that enables us to say, okay, there's multiple things. And then where we then come in is, okay, looking at that state of play, what things can we do to help reduce some of those issues that will enable the teacher to be able to do their job? And of course, it can be argued that labelling has an impact in some ways that are negative, but also positive. And I think the principle of this idea around labelling is that, you know, when you're told a label or you're told something over and 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 over again, you start to internalize what those labels are, and then your behavior, your thoughts, your ideas may reflect what those particular labels are. So we've seen it many times working in an alternative provision, for example, and a child's been told because of their behavior, it's because I've got ADHD, for example. And then I've met kids that say, I behave like this because I got ADHD.
Yeah.
And is it because you got ADHD, or are you choosing to behave like that? And that's not negating that you've got ADHD, but it's about when we work with each other, you don't mess about. So that means you're choosing when and when not to do it. And that's what I'm saying, is that when we look at these issues, if you want to call them that, or challenges, are we looking at them through silos and thinking labelling causes that? Or are we looking at it through multiple lenses that enable us to have a better understanding of what's going on? Because even us being in this room, I'm not just a man. I'm young, I'm black, but I'm from Birmingham. Does that make sense? So even those little intersects may make us very different in terms of our approaches, even being in this room. And I think that that's also part of the problem. But again, I'm using that empathy to also recognize, because I've got loads of colleagues that work within education, and they will say, listen, Craig, this is very complex and difficult. The kids that need therapy, the kids that need, you know, support, you know, having a mentor that comes to the school every hour a week is not enough. And is the mentor enough for that child or young person? And then you've also got to talk about them having to do all of their session plans, and they've got all of these things that they have to do. That little child that's in the classroom that's being disruptive, for whatever reason may be, it's not necessarily the label that we're giving it, but he's being disruptive because I've got 45 or 50 minutes to nail this particular outcome that I also need to demonstrate to my line manager and others that I'm doing what I'm being paid to do. Yeah. And it's all of those different challenges that kind of have the ingredients to create recipes of whether it's disaster or success.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I think when you talk about being able to see, you know, students or young people who have those sort of behaviours, but seeing it through like multiple lenses and not just the silo lens, it's the expectation that, essentially, that's a skill set. That's a skill set that we've been able to, you know, develop through our work, you know, and our practices, etc. But some teachers may not have that, because for them, my skill set is to be able to teach, you know, this certain, you know, subject. So if they have students who are going, you know, who are going through things and are showing their type of, you know, those type of behaviours, but they don't have the skill set to support, manage, you know, or guide that student, is it then like the school's responsibility to sort of commission like external like services, or is it, you know, training? Like, how do you
I'll let Joe flow in, and then I've got a perspective on that.
I think it's, you know, teachers already do way more than teach, right? They act as therapists in the classroom. They act as counsellors. They do way more. They're social workers. They do way more than their teachers. Mm. I think so often when you speak to people that don't understand the young people from the types of communities that we're from, the whole conversation is all about this utopia place of educational excellence that they want to create. An environment that kind of optimizes an environment where everyone can thrive and learn to their best of their ability. What we're talking about, for me, is really simple. It's about humanizing the classroom experience.
That was the word I was going to use.
It's about humanizing the classroom experience. Yeah. Mm. And for me, that's not about saying the teacher needs to now do X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
It's it, again, going back to something I've said already, is about how do we push services and resources further upstream and do things differently, you know, and spend the money, because it sounds expensive, right, to do things in a preventative capacity, but also, like I said before, what we're doing is not currently working. You know, what we're doing is picking up the pieces when things have gone wrong. So for me, I don't think necessarily that a teacher should be able to have all these critical lenses and specialist knowledge of all the different intersecting needs of 30 children in her classroom when she's teaching 6 or 7 different classes a day. That's not realistic. Mm-hmm. It's about how can we holistically support the development of a child from as early as possible. And it's that interdisciplinary systems approach that is needed.
And that was the word I was going to use when you were speaking, you know, bringing humanity back into the work that we're doing. Mm. So when you're saying that you're hearing us coming from different perspectives, is because that's at its root. You know, we talk about being child-centred, person-centred, and without using all of these fancy words, what it is just about just bring humanity back into everything that we're doing. So when you're working with a child, or when I'm working with a teacher, or working with a parent, it's understanding that you're a human being first, and there's a whole bunch of things that come with you as a unique individual. And that's why I use that word intersection, because one person's needs may be very different to someone else's, and a child may be stressed because they're dealing with mum's needs. You know, a child may be stressed because they're getting a vibe from the teacher that they don't like them for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it's about how do we unpack that? But I think if we bring humanity back into education, we bang humanity back into environments. The point that was made earlier about this idea of change, we don't then seek to just look at numbers and data and outcomes. We start then to think about how do we breathe life into the children and young people that we're working with. Yeah. And I think if we can think about how do we breathe life into children and young people, it moves beyond just the kind of academic, you know, outputs that you're going to get. And I'll give one anecdotal example. When I used to lecture at university, the students that I had in my first year typically were students that would have come from, you know, educational environments and backgrounds where they were probably seen not to probably get to the top, all the top marks at that particular point. But most of the work that I did in the first semester was breathing life into the students, motivation, leadership, you know, mentoring. And what you find is that when you, and the research also backs this, that when you start doing that with individuals, even though academically they may not be seen to be, for example, A-star students, you realize because they love the educators and they love the systems that feel human, it makes them want to engage. Yeah. And when I think about my own educational experience, when I think about when I've got a good grade, there's a direct correlation between the teacher that I liked, maybe because they gave me a look of food on break time, maybe because they, you know, sat with us in the canteen and made a little joke with us. Maybe they decided to play football with us, you know, outside. And it's those little nuances that enable us to be like, you know what, when I go to Mr. Barrett's class, I'm just going to behave in it and I'm going to try a little bit harder. So it's not that these children and young people don't have the ability to be able to be great, but who is breathing life into them? But if you're in an environment where teachers are so focused on trying to get the job done, it doesn't give them time to be able to do some of that.
Yeah, and that breathing life part, to me, is just empowerment.
Yeah.
Like when we look at, I speak about prevention all the time, and we automatically go to a deficit-based model and talk about protecting, safeguarding. And obviously safeguarding is critical, right? Of course. It's protecting a child. But for me, is what sits alongside that. It's the empowerment piece that is missing. So when I'm talking about alternative metrics, is how do we empower the child, and how are we measuring that? Do you know, what does that look like, and how are we equipping and empowering the staff and the professionals that work with that child, equipping the parents, equipping the community to develop that child in the same way? And I think that empowerment piece is so important. Yeah. And essentially, what you're saying, Craig, is strength-based models. We're in a strength-based approaches to develop who that child is, which is often intangible. But I think there are ways that we can quantify and measure it. It's just we have to dare to do things in a way that's different to how they're being done now.
Yeah, no, that's important. Thank you for sharing. That's insightful. And there's something that I want to touch upon very quickly. You've both mentioned, you know, the importance of like the interdisciplinary, you know, working, between, like, you know, families and agencies, etc. Often we find that that only happens as a reaction to something. So even in my current role, if there's an issue with a young person or someone on the caseload, okay, multi-agency meeting, get social work, and get
camp police. When most people sit around the table is after someone's been stabbed.
After
someone's been stabbed, there's healthcare, there's education.
All of that, So that only happens, you know, reactionary. How do we get the sort of interdisciplinary working with families and all of these key agencies to come together at an earlier stage that doesn't involve an incident, it goes
back to what's already been said. It's about the idea of change, isn't it? You know, and change is, as I said before, it's uncomfortable. And I think what you're alluding to and what I hear from what you're asking is that we need real change, and it needs to be a radical change. And it needs to be a complete constructive change. And I guess what we're calling for is we need a kind of, you know, Joe said, I love that word, reimagining. And I think we need to reimagine the education system, because the way in which the system is currently running, similar with the criminal justice system, which actually has links when we're talking about the nursery or the school to prison pipeline, it's based on a model that is reactionary. It doesn't function on, from a criminological perspective, it doesn't function on what we would call a public health model, where it does seek to look at root causes. It seeks to look at what are the nuances and the factors that cause and trigger and exacerbate and create those environments for these particular things to happen over again. And I guess when we start thinking about what does that reimagination look like, it's about how do we challenge some of those systems. And I think the journey is difficult because we're talking from a place of public health hearts, but the system is very much rigid. So, for example, me being in criminal justice, we know that, you know, spending time with individuals for long periods of time and not having only six sessions is more beneficial. But then if you've got a metrics that says, you know, you need outcomes within 6 to 8 weeks because social workers need to be involved and a report needs to be written and we need to log something down on the system. I've worked with kids for 20 years and I've seen change in 9. But you can't go into a meeting and say it might take 9 years for some of these children to... And that's what I'm saying, because it's a different approach. And I think if you just look at, you know, spaces or places around the world or even closer to home or somewhere like Glasgow, I know it's separate to the topic, but the point I'm making is a public health model was utilised in order to reduce knife crime. That particular model seek to look at the underlining and root causes, because they reimagined how they're going to look at criminal justice responses to these particular issues, and Glasgow being a knife crime capital. And I think if we can look at those things, and even if it's a tokenistic way, and at least look at that to start thinking about what our foundations look like, then it might then start to knock on the doors of not just schools, but maybe the Department for Education start having a reimagining of what does that look like. Ofsted then start thinking about, okay, this is how we need to start, and then it starts to trickle down in that way. Or there's the alternative, which is about how then you create systems for yourselves in your own communities, similar to movements of the past that create environments, whether that is a secondary or supplementary education, that enable people to thrive. So when I was younger, I was part of, you know, the Pan-Africanist Marcus Garvey movement. So I was one of the children on the weekends where I had extracurricular school. Maybe that's why I'm so intelligent. Why? Because the teachers then breathe life into us. You know, they made me believe I could be a leader, and they made me believe that I could be, and despite the fact that I was dyslexic, despite the fact that, you know, there was all these labels that that society and school was giving me, I was able to demonstrate that years later. But I was fortunate in the sense of I grew up in a time where the labels wasn't as harsh, and the labels weren't linked to medication, that weren't linked to the labels that will put me into an alternative provisional, you know, pupil referral unit. Those are the days I missed. So when I think about the, you know, the children of today, Those are the challenges. And when we look at, we have to go back to systems of racism. And we have to also start to understand, and as Professor Carleen Fermin always talks about, that these ideas, you know, need to be considered safeguarding issues. Because if these labels and these things and these behaviours that exist within these systems are used to then further adversely impact individuals that then potentially may look like me or come from a particular background, and it's not just about race, it's also about class, and it's also about gender. And we look at all of these different things, who are being impacted the most.
Yeah.
And I think these conversations for me then become even more important.
I think you touched on an important point there. You spoke about the heart of what we do. And essentially that's what gets me up every day. Mm. You know, it is, I guess you could say I'm connected to the ethical part of what's happening in children's lives, right? And then I think we're talking about how can you have that intersectional or that interdisciplinary systems focus at an earlier stage. To me, without being skeptical, it's kind of like, who really cares? Who, the ethical side of it, is that enough of an argument? Mm. So for me, a big piece of work that we've been doing recently, and it's always been an issue of with our work and our focus, how do you measure prevention, is looking at cost-benefit analysis. So we often look at what happens when we do work with the child, and that's the piece that we're asked to evidence or to promote for our work. Whereas cost benefit analysis, it really simplistically is asking what happens if they don't, you know. So for me, the way how we get people to sit at the table is it a speaking their language and saying you can save this amount of money by investing earlier. You know, that the national data is compelling for, you know, what is being spent at a reactionary level versus what is being spent at preventative level. And so for me, in the work that we're doing now, we're leading with those figures and working with local authorities to deepen the understanding of that at a local level and then bringing in the solutions. So for us, then a second part of that conversation is, okay, well, if we're saving money here, if we're even reducing school exclusions within the borough by 10%, what could you do with that money? So it's speaking their language, you know. Mm-hmm. So for me, and it's a shame that we have to come from that angle, right, and make that the focus, but if that's what gets people at the table earlier on, I think then that's a possible win.
Yeah, you know what, it's just listening to both of you guys, my mind is working overtime right now, because my current role in the local authority where I work, my role and my team's role is around, you know, how do we reduce, you know, school exclusions in the borough. And I think one of the issues that, you know, we've had, and I'm someone that I'm always ready to speak up, you know, within my team if there's like an injustice or whatever else, is that yes, we've had a focus on reducing, you know, school exclusions, but it's been data driven. It's been, oh, in 2023, we only had 7 exclusions in the borough.
Yeah.
2024, we've only had, you know, 5. And then next year, it's just going to be about the data. Mm. And then if it keeps going down, yes, it looks like we're succeeding. But the thing that you guys are really driving is, actually, let's look at the individuals. Let's look at the families, you know, how's the young person's well-being? How's the young person's well-being? What's their motivation? You know, what's their aspiration? How's the family context? You know, what support are they getting? And looking just beyond the reports and the academia and, you know, they're at this level or they're at that level, but really trying to build, you know, a holistic picture so we get an understanding of, you know, this is a sense of the young person.
The empowerment work is happening, right? We all know examples where there's examples of good practice, there's examples of bad practice, right? But 100% there's teachers. I could probably say in every school there's a teacher or a member of staff who's doing positive work or has had positive impact on a child, but we don't measure it. So those statistics that we do know, when a local authority can turn around to you and say, well, we've reduced exclusions by X percentage over such and such years, doesn't tell the story. How have you equipped that child to thrive whatever they go on to next? How have you prepared that child for the world? Rather than just saying, we've got that child through education without excluding them, and they're spat out the other end to go into the next system that they're in, you know? So for me, it's not saying, when I'm saying we need to reimagine education, yes, I think there is a need for a radical reimagining of education, but there is also a need to quantify the good work that is already being done.
Agreed.
What does that look like though? How do you measure that? What would be the metrics, or what would be the criteria to measure like someone's progress?
Yes. Recently, I was playing around with a model that you'll be familiar with, Craig, the 6 C's of youth empowerment. And we changed it to the 10 C's of youth empowerment, but we combined it with the benevolent childhood experiences model, which is seen as an antidote, or as some research has seen it as an antidote to adverse childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So there's now 10 C's, which are things like communication, character, caring, coping. So across those areas, and we've used it, and we called it the empowerment continuum. And used it as a model to encompass safeguarding the journeys.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we're safeguarding this child at this specific point, but we wrap the empowerment continuum around them, and this dictates or provides a metric for how we are measuring the child or the program, whatever it is, whether it's a mentoring program, we say, okay, these are the areas that we want to develop the child in. And then also, how could that translate to the parents? You know, they could work with those same C's. So for me, that's a big part of my work, is looking at, you know, strength-based models as conceptual lenses to look at some of these critical issues, and not just having the deficit-based models that all the conversations seem to be heavily focused on.
And are we saying that this is something that we would only use, or are we saying that these are approaches that we would only use for children who have been identified in like sort of early year settings as having issues? Or are we saying?
No, I think it's for all. I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, we're looking at issues specific for certain types of young people, and I get it. But if we just go back before the cuts, 2009, 2010, 2011, we had the riots of 2011. The way in which we worked in education, and the way in which we had support and then also government-funded things that were happening within our society at the time. You may remember things like EMA. You may remember things like Sure Start. So it wasn't just about education, but it was the understanding that in a holistic way, there's so many things that then lead and connect into different types of things. Now, when David Cameron then came in post-2012, you may remember Theresa May, you know, launched the Ending Gangs and Serious Youth Violence policy. And I would say that that's when the game changed.
Mm.
And it wasn't just education, it was other entities as well. And the focus was solely on the kids that are what I call the cause of concern.
Yeah.
And then whilst we focused on the kids that was the cause of concern, what the government did was that they redirected certain fundings that they didn't want to pay for certain things no more, and that's why loads of things within school were removed, and then it's now highly dependent on the pastoral team to do absolutely everything within the school, and a couple of rogue teachers that want to do a little bit more. But then everybody then became a specialist. And everybody was a specialist in this and that area, and then your contextual safeguarding leads started to pop up, and your safeguarding leads, and then the names of like CCE then popped up, and then everybody became a specialist. And then whilst we think about 2013 up until today's point, what we've then started to see is that the focus of children that are the cause of concern has been so much that we've now forgot about what I call the regular kid that goes to school, that doesn't cause any problems and just navigates his way. So when I think about my son, and I say to him, and when we have conversations, and he'll be like, oh yeah, the mentors came into the school to work with who? To work with you guys, or just to work with the kids that were the cause of concern? He'll be like, oh yeah, the ones that were, you know, mess about. So then I would ask the question, so why can't my son get a mentor? To empower him, to breathe life into him. Are we now saying that if you are doing the right thing, meaning you come to school, you do all your classes, you do the best that you can, that you're not going to get any external or internal support whatsoever because you're doing what you're doing. And what we're seeing, going back to our original point of the conversation, the school to prison pipeline, what I'm finding in my work is the kids that are doing the right thing are the ones that are turning to drugs, are turning to, you know, drug dealing or going on a county line or holding weapons or online and social media platforms. They're engaging in things that they shouldn't because nobody's giving them attention. So I think this kind of hyper focus on the kids that are the cause of concern and using any apparatus or metrics or any kind of impact type of assessment, only focusing on those kids without ignoring the wider set of the children in the room, I think that's when that also then can become a potential problem.
I think that's that. I'll just touch on a tiny point there. For me, when I was working in the statutory space, statutory sector, one of the phrases that used to really bug me was when they used to say a child slipped through the net. Yeah. For me, a child didn't slip through the net. The signs weren't spotted. The support wasn't given. The love wasn't given. The empowerment wasn't provided. No child, after they've been through 17 years of education, should have ever slipped through the net. So for me, I think, you know, we need to introduce some of the systems that we're talking about and ways of reimagining empowerment and learning within education space across the board. And of course, targeted support is still critical. It's still important. So it's not either or. I think it's both and. You know, we need to have a reimagining of the way the current education system is, as in, you know, what is measured, the current metrics, the curriculum, everything how it's set out now. I think it's fair to say it's not fit for purpose in these times. That from the ground up needs to be addressed. And then within that, what does targeted and specialist support look like for the groups that we know are most vulnerable and at risk?
Yeah, that's important. That's important. Thank you for sharing. I wanted to ask you as well, because this is something that within, you know, the work that I do that I always think is important, you know, is the voice of the young people, the voice of the youth that we work with. And I think everyone's got a voice. I don't care if, you know, you're in a PRU, an AP, if you've just come out of prison, whatever it may be, you've got a voice. Like, how important do you both feel like is the voice of, you know, the youth in terms of sharing their experiences of navigating, you know, the education system with specific focus on those who have been, you know, in sort of PRUs, alternative provisions, or in and out of the criminal justice system? Like, how important are those voices? Because often I find that once they leave mainstream education,
it's not just important, it's imperative, you know, that the child's voice is centered. I think what I'll say to that though is that it's done authentically and that it's done in a way that is genuinely centering the child's voice and not just another tokenistic trend. Like, there's always there's always different labels and trends or, you know, current ways in which we're expected to work in this space, right? And I think co-production and youth-led voice is front and center at the moment. And for me, being somebody that is a lived experience leader, I think I've shied away from that because it put me in a box. It was like, oh, let's bring on the guy that works with young people that's got tats and has been to prison. And for me, it was like, I don't want to speak. I don't want to be invited to speak somewhere because of that gimmick. I want to be invited to speak somewhere because of the work that I'm doing. Yeah. You know, so I think when we're not authentically engaging lived experience or centering the child's voice, it becomes extractive and exploitive. You know, we need to make sure we're centering it properly. And I think sometimes it can feel like that, right? Where, you know, someone from outside of the community swoops into a space, puts a little table and some coffee and biscuits and speaks to people in the community, takes the day to go out and the community don't benefit or never hear anything again. You know, it needs to be more of a holding process. I think that's, you know, the beauty of community-based organizations who are embedded within the communities, who understand the people that they work with. They can do things and connect to people in the ways that, you know, I guess the people up here can't. Yeah. You know, so I think that for me, centering a child's voice
is imperative, but we have to do it in the right way. And also, what happens with that child, how we communicate in the process, you know, I think, yeah, I've seen that as a title, co-production, you know, it almost seems to be a trend, right? And I think for me, it's so important, but we have to do it in the right way.
Yeah. And I mirror that authenticity at its root. You know, you heard me say that things need to be and should be child and person-centred. And when I talk about humanity, bringing humanity back, authenticity is also at its root. And I think enabling young people to find their voice, I think, is also imperative as well. Because we assume when we're saying find their voice, it means sometimes words, expression, and understanding the way that they can express, whether that's through the arts, whether that's through music, you know, whether that's through role play, drama, whether that may be the voice is essential because, one, it teaches us new things. You know, youth trends, youth cultures, you know, they're fluid, it's not static. And I think the voice, you know, why probably we're so successful in the things we do with young people in wider settings is because we're constantly fluid and understanding and up to date. And young people are our teachers. I use the concept of, you know, we lead from behind. We don't lead from the front. The young people are our teachers. And what we do is enable them. We empower them. We give them build their resilience and their character and all of the things that's just been mentioned to enable them to be the leaders of tomorrow. And I think that comes as a process. You know, they're not aliens, you know, in a laboratory. We're all standing behind the glass trying to figure out how to work with these kids. And I think it's about how do we, you know, connect with young people at all levels. And when I went back to when I was making that point about pointing the finger and talking about being cultural competent, cultural sensitive, and all of those things, when I'm talking about culture, I'm not saying it's race always specific. Sometimes it's just youth culture. You know, if you're working in an inner city school and you don't know what an Air Force One is, and you don't know what a Jordan One is, and you don't know what Vans are, and you don't know what the things are trending on social media, the question I would ask is, what are you doing? Or are you going with this mindset of, I'm just coming to teach maths. I'm just coming to teach science. And you're not thinking about you're working with human beings, because you wouldn't go home and expect anybody to engage with your children like that. And I think it's about working from a place of, you know, we're part of the village. You know, we use these kind of analogies and these, you know, what I call old school sayings, like it takes the village to raise a child. But I like to add on to that, and it also takes some of the villagers to kill our children if we don't work with them properly.
Yeah. I think, you know, exactly what you said, I think it requires us to come to a place of humility. I think a key point that is often missed when it comes to centering the child's voice is how willing are we, if we center the child's voice, to do things in the way that we didn't think was the best way in the beginning. Because sometimes by authentically centering the child's voice or the community's voice means that what you are going to do, whatever your output is or whatever your process is going to be completely different to what you thought it was. It might take longer. You might go on a completely different route. And I think that's the key part, is we can listen to the child's voice and have all of these, you know, really nice sounding sound bites and headlines. But if we're going to actually authentically center their voice, we have to enter the process with a level of humility to say, look, I don't have, if I'm centering their voice, that means I'm positioning them as the expert, you know, and that takes humility as a leader to do. You know, I did a community consultation process for one of my programs recently, and the easiest thing for me, or the most natural thing, was to go from A to B, you know, problem to solution. That's the business mind that I have. That seemed like the most obvious route. Where essentially going through the community consultation process was like going in a big U shape from problem to solution, you know, and that took time. It took patience. It took, you know, we kind of re-diverting where we thought we were going with the program and we had to add in new elements and change things, you know. So I think for me, I've learned, you know, I already said that, you know, I cautious when I use the term lived experience and how we engage with that. But I think I challenge some of my own beliefs and the ways that I, you know, engage myself in those processes through that experience.
No, that's important. That's important. Thank you again for sharing. And, you know, just as we finish off, I know you both do some amazing work, you know, within the community, and you know, we've been speaking about, you know, empowerment and breathing life, you know, into our youth, and that's something that I'm always conscious of, and I shared this in a previous episode, because when I left uni, I went to work for the Youth Offending Service. And I said, you know what, similar to you in terms of like lived experiences, I was like, you know what, I want to give back and whatever else. So I was working for the Youth Offending Service for about 2-3 years. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation, because at the time of working at the Youth Offending Service, I was saying to myself, I need to get to these kids before they get here. Mm. So then I went to education. So now I'm seeing how I started to, you know, to sort of work down that route. But I was always conscious of, how do I empower, you know, the students that I work with? You know, how do I empower them? How do I give them that motivation and whatever else, so, you know, they can go on and be leaders and whatever else? And I always, you know, and I share as well, on the social media platforms, etc., like the amount of former students that will message me, like, sir, you know, we're looking into your podcast, like, everyone's love it. And I've left that role, you know, years ago. And I know, and I say that to say that I know you are both doing, you know, some amazing things, and I think it will be good to sort of share with the audience a bit more about, you know, what you guys are doing in terms of like your respective fields, so they can just have a greater understanding before we close off of the amazing work that you're both doing.
Got a job. Okay. Yeah, so as an organization, the Center for Youth Violence and Conflict, there's essentially three things that we hope to do. So one is around enabling professionals to understand all forms of extrafamilial harm. So that's everything from the serious youth violence agenda, gun and knife crime, urban street gangs, criminal exploitation of all forms, sexual exploitation, radicalization, extremism, violence against girls and young women. And I guess the second level of the work that we do is around, how do we mobilize communities? How do we get communities to be on part with some of the concerns that we have within our, you know, wider setting? So whether that would be getting key stakeholders, that might be an imam, a priest, a spiritual leader, or whatever, to get them to be involved and within their congregations, not just talk about one thing, but also talk about things that kids are dealing with in their own community. And I guess the third thing that we do is working directly with children and young people. So whether that is we working in schools and colleges, alternative provisions, youth centres, wherever children and young people are, and we have a youth team that go out and kind of deal with that. And then aside to that, you know, I didn't mention this in the beginning as well, we do have a children's home. We've got 2 children's homes in the West Midlands. And that is a way for me to, one, you know, children that have been taken into care by Children's Services, we provide children a home, 24/7 care. But it's also about, how do we help members of the community to get jobs? Mm. You know, so it's about, how do we deal with the whole system and the structures that have failed people? Mm. And then that's rewarding for me, because one, I'm helping children. 2, I'm helping members of the community. And then I guess my passion is very much, you know, what my right hand over here is, you know, is about research. You know, how are we researching things that in ultimately made systems better? Mm. And I didn't say it at the beginning. And it's funny that when we've been talking about education, I'm finishing my PhD. And, you know, I always tell myself, I left school with no GCSEs, and with all of the labels that the education system gave me, I'm now almost completing one of the highest, you know, educational things you can attain. Yeah. But the question is, why did I do it? Which goes back to the previous point before you asked that question. I just want to be. Mm. I want to show the man, them, young people, those that are, you know, in different spaces around our nation, that can be like, you know what, you can come from these types of environments and you can make it however they view making it, or you can reach at least the highest success within education and being your authentic self.
Yeah.
And that's what I stand for. So for me, that's probably the root of most of what I'm doing. You know, is to be my authentic self. I've never changed. I've never acted a certain way. I don't conform to the way in which people want me to be, in the way in which is kind of alien to who I am as a human being and also my community. And I think that, for me, is what the essence of what Solve is all about. How do we solve people's problems, and sometimes solving problems through how we act, how we move, how we're seen is the root of what I do.
No, that's powerful. That's powerful. Thank you for sharing. How about you, Joe?
Yeah, so congratulations, Craig, by the way, for coming to the end of your PhD. I know that's a journey. And one actually that I'm just about to embark on. So the same sentiments that Craig shared, you know, I think I sit back and look at my journey with gratitude. You know, I left prison in 2016 and kind of have been navigating my way in this sector since then. And I'm just about to complete my MPhil at the University of Cambridge and then going straight on to do my PhD, researching the school-to-prison pipeline. And I think Craig spoke about why he did it, why he did your PhD. And for me, it was the research to validate the approach, right? The preventative angle. I've been beating that drum from the beginning.
Mm.
You know, you can't little boy me and put me in just the lived experience box anymore, because I have the knowledge to back it up. I have the research to back it up. So for me, even navigating that environment has been, you know, very interesting. I've learned so much. I've learned so much about myself. But I think, you know, it's had a lot of effects. I think it's validated externally, people understanding my approach and the work that I do, but also internally. I think, you know, there's lots of narratives that we can come to believe in terms of limitations of how we can progress and what can be achieved. And I think, you know, I said earlier on about change is disruptive, and I'm happy to be the disruptor, you know. For me, what I'm doing is about equipping myself to allow me to then be in spaces and places that I wouldn't have access to before. So the work that I'm doing through my organization, we focus on a localized approach, but that inter-systems change, that systems change work. And we're working with the local authorities, and we have like five focus groups, so black and minoritized children, children from low socioeconomic backgrounds, care experienced children, special educational needs, and social, emotional, and mental health. And we look at those groups through the early transitions, so from early years into reception, key stage one to key stage two, and primary to secondary. And we look at how we can support the local authority through a transitional safeguarding framework. So we do an exploratory piece of research in the beginning. We get on the ground and center the voice of the child and the community to understand how through those transitions we could improve, support, and enhance and empower the different stakeholders more. And then we work with them over an extended period of time to implement whatever the recommendations are from the report. And then within that, we have several programs. So one of our main programs is called My Next Steps and looks at the transition from primary to secondary school. We are just about to launch a pilot of that for a digital learning platform that has a comprehensive suite of sessions for students. And there's also CPD sessions for school staff. And there's a whole element for parents too. So, the academic work that I'm doing and the work that I'm doing professionally all align. So there's a lot of plates that are being spun at the moment. And, you know, it's actually an honor to share this space with someone like Craig, you know, who's ahead of where I am in my journey. But, you know, I think that's the beautiful thing about being in this space. And Craig's been a mentor to me in many ways without even knowing it. Just because you can, when you can see examples of people who are in the space doing that work, you know, that's incredible, you know. And you spoke about those moments where, you know, we're talking about kind of big systems change. And I think to bring the lens inwards, sometimes it's those interpersonal moments that are so key, and those planting of seeds. And I'm testament to people that have loved me more than I've loved myself, people that have believed in me more than I've believed in myself at times. And I think when you're able to see people who are on that journey and who have walked the walk, you know, that's an incredible level of support. So yeah. I feel blessed to be doing the work that I'm doing. And also I wanted to thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, likewise, bro.
Honestly, it's been amazing to have, you know, both of you guys on. I'm someone that I always say I'm very meticulous in terms of like who I, you know, invite on. And it's not just, you know, I see someone and like I'm preying work.
Yeah. And I was gassed when you said Joel's like, coming.
You know, we was chopping it up on the phone as well earlier. I'm just seeing like everything that everyone's doing. But even recording this now and like listening to your feedback, there was times when I can't even think about my discussion points because you've just both put things in my head that's made me feel like, yeah, I need to go back to the drawing board. I need to go back to the drawing board. I need to study. I need to read. Because I'm someone that, like, I'll even take this back to my work colleagues and be like, no, we need to think about things in this way. Mm. Or we need to look at things, you know, through this lens.
The good thing, and just a quick point I always say, is a good place to start is reigniting fires, is what I call it. Self-exploration sessions with your team. Start to get them to connect to their why. That's normally a good start or restart, you know, especially when we're talking about burnout and, you know, high turnovers of stress and anxiety and all of those things. Get people to, you know, I like the theme today is reimagining education. Get people to reignite their fires by getting them to explore their why.
That's powerful. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
So, gents, it's been a pleasure having you guys on. You've definitely given me a lot of food for thought. And, you know, I'm sure many of our followers and the audience, etc., will definitely be sort of locking into the episode with excitement, especially for those who are keen to understand this female school to prison pipeline a bit better as well. So thank you again. So that has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow us on our social media and subscribe to our YouTube page. Thank you.